anti-attack on a mobile phone user. So I'm pretty much into nonviolence. So nonviolent means I'm looking at creativity. So if anyone's got a mobile phone and still on, think about turning it off. This one's in response to which, you know, if you're going to give me a good question. I'm after questions all the time. We've only got like something in the order of 60 slides to get through in about 75 minutes. So we're still going to be rushing through slides, but at the end of the day, because there's no demo, we've got plenty of time for Q&A, so don't mind any questions at any time. Okay. Just going briefly through our agenda today. Basically, we've got an introduction, 10 reasons why honeypots suck, and I'll probably go through a little bit at that stage about what is a honeypot. How many people just off the cuff know what a honeypot is? Cool. That's great. And don't get me wrong, this is not an attack on people like, you know, the HoneyNet guys or anything like that. It's really about current implementations and why, in a corporate environment, honeypots and HoneyNets aren't such a great idea. I was going to give you a couple of demos, but without VMware being able to bring up a network card, I just cannot demonstrate it, so there's no point in really mucking around. And the reality is, in your notes, you should actually have a copy of these slides. Unlike most of the presentations that I've been to so far, they're actually the ones I'm going to be demonstrating. The reality is when I do my job, I would assume that most of you are in the same profession, there's a few things that you really see time and time again. If you don't address these basic things, then there's no point in putting even a basic network IDS in. Okay, who is he? Well, I'm a senior architect at eSecure. I do mostly larger clients, telcos, mining companies, that sort of thing, financial institutions. I work mostly all over Australia. I am the proud slave of two cats. Got two MCSEs for what it's worth. And realistically, my faith in that little certification is diminishing by the day. I spend a fair amount of my time after hours just playing around on my NetBSD Alpha box. For the demonstration here, I was actually trying to get NetBSD running, but for the same reasons that I've had troubles with VMware, I actually changed across to FreeBSD because it had IP filter still. But at the end of the day, it didn't actually work. Sage AU, who's familiar with Sage? Sage US or any of the other sort of system administrator guilds? Well, you should be. If you've got system administrators or security administrators, it's an excellent organization to belong to. The peer support of those organizations is excellent. It brings up the level of system and security administration in your organization. Most of the time, the Australian ones are like 88 Australian dollars, which is bargain. Enough plug-in Sage AU. My duties with the DNS competition panel in Australia have actually now finished. It's equivalent to what CIRA did up in Canada last year. We are actually just about to have our final report published, so that's going to be rather exciting. Now, this is actually the correct orientation. Australia is up there. I come from the bit that's just below the island that's at the top that's often forgotten. And I used to live in Sydney for about 2 years, but most of the time I've been living in Melbourne. eSecure is one of Australia's largest security consulting firms. I think after a few cuts at other organisations, we are probably the largest now. We have about 50 people. We do nothing. We don't sell products. We don't do any sort of product placement. We don't resell anything. We just do warm bodies. Theoretically, we are platform and vendor neutral. The reality is that we work with the products that our clients have selected. Okay. Now, how many of you actually know what ITIL is? That's about what I expected. ITIL is an excellent infrastructure library. If you guys are interested, it's a UK/EU initiative. The actual books themselves are very expensive. Once you've got the complete library, you'll be sitting close to about US $1,000 or thereabouts. There's about 30 or 40 volumes. The reality is that it really helps you bootstrap a very large organization into a standards-based thing. It's the equivalent of accounting's general accounting practices. Double entry booking keeping and things like that. It's basically saying, this is how we'd like to see large sites set up. So you don't get a lot of different architectures, but the ones that are there do work very nicely. How many of you would say that all of your hosts are patched and secure? Well, it's as secure as you know they are, but they can be today. Yep. How many of you absolutely trust every single one of your staff members? Yep. And how many of you actually have a risk management group? Well, that's actually a bit disappointing because most of the clients I actually work in do have a risk management group. In some ways, many of you outsource your risk management then to insurance agencies in other areas. For example, you actually buy insurance for property, you buy insurance for how your actual company goes, you buy life insurance. You are off or outselling or outsourcing your actual risk management to other entities. And by doing so, you're actually outsourcing the policy of that. If you have your own internal risk management group, you will actually be able to bring back that policy setting function. Okay, most of the time I see a lot of wasted expenditure. I'm pretty sure that most of you guys probably see the same sort of thing. I'm probably teaching you guys how to suck eggs. I'm apologizing in advance if I'm going to teach you anything that you already know. Realistically, you're much better off spending money on virus protection, automated software distribution and backups than you are to spend it on any security products whatsoever. It's a terrible thing to say as a security person, but the reality is these are threats we do see. Some risks are completely and utterly overhyped and get far too much press. And in some ways, I think honeypots are in that sort of category. If you do not have a repeatable, secure host installation, the ability to just simply pop a CD in and wait for a machine to be rebuilt into a secure configuration, you are like most organizations, and it is not unusual. But that one simple step will help make your DMZ, at least a bunch of trusted hosts, that much more secure. Okay, roughly what is a honeypot? A honeypot is a bunch of software that attempts to emulate known buggy software. Sometimes they don't even attempt to emulate it, they just simply open up a port on a particularly well-known port like 111 and pretend to answer RPC queries. Now, the reality is, if you go to Ophir Arkin's talk on X tomorrow, I believe it is, in the deep knowledge area, you will learn that there is no way to hide advanced attackers from figuring out what you are running, and they can identify you down to almost service pack or hotfix or patch cluster level. The reality of that against what an application program, which itself may contain bugs, is there's no way you're going to hide from an advanced attacker. You don't really learn anything new. We know that RDS is the major single source of IIS attacks today. We know that SunRPC attacks are the most popular way of getting into Solaris Box today. By putting in software that emulates these attacks, I don't think we learn anything new. The attacker will basically send a bunch of automated attacks at you, and one of them seems to succeed for them. Most of the time, with the latest bunch of attacks, they're so automated that there's actually one called the SAAdminD worm. The actual attack that it launches itself is actually from a Solaris box, and there is no one actually running that box. They're not actually interested in the results. So you don't really learn anything new. All you know is that there's a whole bunch of really weak Solaris boxes out there if you're an IIS administrator. Now, all software has defects. There is absolutely no software in the world today, with the exception of very, very small or very, very expensive and very custom software, mainly developed by people like NASA, that has no defects. Zero defect software is a pipe dream. The reality is that people are forced to push out software to a deadline. If there's a defect, and I call them defects because that's what they are, people call them bugs, some people call them, you know, oh, that's just a bit of a problem, you just work around it like this. The reality is it's defects. When people like Dan Bernstein can develop code with one bug per 1,000 lines, and that's considered best practice, the reality is that all software will have some form of defect. Normal code has 5 to 15 bugs per 1,000 lines. and it varies depends on the developer and the language they use. Some languages, such as Java and C++ to some extent, and Ada, really do go out of their way to help you protect yourself from the actual language. But most people who program today in systems languages and other sorts of security software prefer to program in C, and C is evil. DTK is the Deception Toolkit. How many people have actually heard of DTK? Does anyone actually write DTK before I go really slagging it off? Fantastic. It's really bad. The reality is DTK is approximately 15,000 lines worth of code with comments. Now, comments themselves can be a source of bugs if they contain code. And sometimes in DTK, code is actually embedded inside them. Once I'd actually done a little bit of a grep and then a bit of a munging, it turned out to be about 9,279 lines. From the quality of the code that I've seen, I'd probably suggest that it's in the 5 to 15 bugs range rather than one bug per 1,000 lines. At least 9 bugs and possibly as many as 30 bugs exist in DTK. And when people install things like DTK on top of a host designed to attract attention, you've got at least 30 defects. And once that person's got control of your host, then you've got a real problem. So where do you start from saying where it's wrong? Well, the insurance model. Bruce Schiner has actually suggested in one of his recent cryptograms that insurance is the way to go forward. And in fact, he bases part of his business upon insuring risk. Now, I think that's possibly a way forward, but most large corporates will just simply self-insure. It's not worth the risk. It's not really worth it to them to worry about one little website here going down. But if you use the insurance model, you do not increase your risk profile, you'll decrease your risk profile. For example, if you're driving a car and you want to actually get a lower premium, the best way to go forward is to get an economy box that has airbags, that has side curtains, that has ABS, and has a burglar alarm. And you'll notice that your premium is actually much less than if you get a Subaru WRX with, say, for example, nitrous oxide and no airbags. And that's the basis of how insurance works. Risk management says that honeypots and things like honeypots increase your risk for demonstrably invalid reasons. What is the purpose of running a honeypot? To attract attention away from your actual systems. Well, what if they're not really interested in just that one system? The entire idea of a deception toolkit or a honeypot is that there's a person behind it attacking you. The reality of the situation is that the vast majority of attacks today are actually conducted by worms and by automated attacks. And realistically, you can learn far more about your attack by using better instrumentation, and I'm talking about IDS there, and better firewall rules, and looking through your logs. The reality is that, I mean, I hope there's no script kiddies in here. I know that we're at a conference called Black Hat, but the reality is that most script kiddies get scripts off places like hack.co.za or PacketStorm, and we'll just simply run them and see what happens. They don't understand the attack. They don't really want to understand the attack. They don't understand how to write the attack. So the reality is that most attackers do not really care that you've got a really, really clever deception or honeypot in there. They'll just keep on running things until they take out one of your systems. Honeypots, like the actual software that you're running to run your mission critical systems, say, for example, your mail server, which is unfortunately these days considered a mission critical system, they've got to be kept up to date. If you don't keep them up to date, they will be attacked and successfully before too long. Honeypots must act like the host operating system, but the reality is if you put a DTK emulating an IIS attack on a Solaris box, even a moderately advanced attacker will be able to tell that and not give you the attacks that you're expecting. And realistically, it's better to spend the time not looking after a honeypot, but to actually spend time looking after your real security profile. That includes your normal servers, that includes internal systems and your processes. I'd love to, but I can't. The result of actually running this one is to show you for example, an RDS attack against DTK. DTK doesn't even log the fact that you've got an RDS attack. It doesn't even can't even tell you that it was an RDS attack, whereas Snort can, out of the box. Now, this is, has anyone been to Peacock Maps or been to a Bill Cheswick talk? Yep. This is a map of the internet approximately June 1999. And you know about exponential growth and everything like that. The sort of a light green area up in there is MCR WorldCom from memory. I'd have to actually go and have a look, or cable and wireless. Yeah, it's cable and wireless. It doesn't show any hosts, it just shows you networks. And it's only the really, really big networks that get on there. And it's very, very, it didn't get dithered down very well. If you actually go and see a real life-size version of this diagram, it's just incredibly complex. The reality is, for an attacker, there is a wealth of targets to go for. Your best bet is to be an almost invisible one. Unfortunately, when you pull the box out of the, when you get something like Red Hat, what happens? You install it, you think it's secure, the reality is very different. When I was working in an ISP, they actually thought about installing Red Hat 6.2 because Red Hat 6.1, which they were running at the time, had a lot of vulnerabilities. These days, if you install Red Hat 6.2 out of the box, people think that's insecure. Things, when you install them, are generally insecure. You do have to take steps to harden them. This is why I got back to the my first couple of slides. I was talking about ensuring that you've actually got latest patches, you run the minimal services, that sort of thing. Operating systems maintained by normal users. Normal users don't really think about an operating system as something they've got to maintain. They would like, to, and this is where the ideal world would be, is that it's just a tool. It's like a hammer. The reality of maintaining a hammer is making sure that the handle doesn't break and that the actual metal bit at the top doesn't actually get too damaged that you can't use it anymore. Computers are nowhere near like that. Things like Windows Update, even though from a security perspective, if you had to actually say, okay, do I trust Microsoft to give me all the fixes I need? The reality of that situation is, well, most of the time it'll work. The very few times that it won't work, well, then we've got a real problem, and so does everybody else. But leaving them unpatched is probably a greater risk. The Red Hat have actually come out with Red Carpet. GNOME have got a GNOME update, I believe, or some other automatic update. This stuff is becoming very, very common, and it'll be a very, very... Or Debian's got apt-get. Automatic updates are a good thing, in my opinion. And if anybody really thinks that we've got no future, the reality is security has got a great future. Risk management. Risk is the number of factors and multiplied by impact multiplied by a likelihood. Most large corporations do have some form of risk management. Has people generally worked in large organizations before, or are you all small to medium enterprise type people? Has lunch sent the audience to sleep? Cool. Most large corporations do have an internal risk management group. And most of the time, they're not focused on IT. They're focused on the big picture. And they often miss IT, even though they really should be keeping their eyes on it. Risk management is not absolute, and most of the time they're not even interested in addressing all of the risks or even most of the risks. They're only interested in the really big ticket items, things that they could not afford to go wrong. Most likelihoods are subjectives, and they are generally expressed in once in every X number of years. For example, where I'm about to build a house, they say, oh, it'll flood once every 100 years. But what happens if the conditions for a flood change? They couldn't say. No one can say. It is possible to determine likelihood, and most actuaries at insurance agencies have a very good idea about how many crashes per 1,000 cars a particular car will have. And then, from that, they can actually calculate how many people will die from those crashes, and then they work that out. It is unfortunate that they know these things, but they can't tell you because it's the basis of them making a profit. Many fire departments actually know the likelihood of any particular building burning down. Most impacts can be relatively accurately expressed in dollars per incident. All you need to do is keep an eye on how many times you need to do a backup and how many people lost time. As long as you've counted all the factors in, you can actually work out to probably the nearest $500 how much it costs per incident to do a particular type of activity. And once you've worked out the most costly, you work on the old 80-20 rule. You address the top 20 issues, you've addressed most of your risk. Okay, cost of attack versus frequency of attack. Down the bottom we've got the dollars, at the top we've got the frequency. When we buy house insurance or car insurance, every premium that I've ever come across has an excess. This is the amount of money that you will set always have to pay out of your pocket. Now, for example, on my most recent car insurance, I could choose between a $400 excess and a $1,000 excess. If I chose the $1,000 excess, my premium was almost 40% less than my original premium. Now, if I shopped around and played around a bit more, I'm probably sure that I can probably get different figures out of them as well. But very few, if none, insurance policies have an excess. Now, how does this actually relate to computers? This is the reality of saying, well, from time to time, you will get hacked. And from time to time, you're going to have to wear the loss. Even if you have an insurance policy, there is a certain amount of work that your organization is going to have to do to recover from that, and that's money you generally can't recover. Self-insuring. Sometimes it's not worth actually going to the insurer and telling them that you've had an incident, because your premiums will go up. Or, alternatively, it's not worth the effort from a publicity point of view or otherwise. In large corporations, in one of the large corporations I worked at, they actually just simply paid all car accidents out of cash. They just refused to worry about insuring cars because for them, they could cope with that loss. And this is where large corporations spend the money. It's the frequency of attacks are very, very minimal, but the loss is very, very large. Most small to medium enterprises use things like bars on windows, and most small enterprises these days just put up with individual personal firewalls. Once large companies, say for example, if you're about to go for an IPO or you're taking other capital in, you will basically have to take an insurance policy out as part of your financial well-being. There aren't that many policies these days, but there will be more. Okay, this is a prize question. What's this building? Who owns this building? I looked it up on the web and it's supposed to be the AT&T Center, is it? Isn't it the AT&T offices in New York? Because that's where I got the picture from. I could take a message, but anyway. I've got one more prize to go. One of the large things that you noticed there was there wasn't any real bars, because they used security guards and alarms and other things. Okay, we're getting onto threat models. The reality of old model thinking is seasoned attacker with extreme skills identifying you individually. This is not the case. If you get that sort of attacker, the only thing you can do is delay them. The reality is that you'll get a script kiddie, like Steve Gibson did a couple of weeks ago. They'll attack you until they succeed, or they'll take you out using another way. The reality is that script kiddies are far, far more common than any other sort of attack. All they do is they collect tools, they tag and brag. RDS attacks are the most common tag and brag these days. And then they attack victims. They just do it until the cows come home. A gifted and amateur attack, realistically, pretty much any entry-level security engineer would be able to conduct this without any additional effort. It is the next obvious level for a script kiddie to go from. You collect tools, you develop your skills, you gather info about your hosts, using tools such as, like for example, the tool that Ophir Arkin's working on, and you attack the victim. The more you know about the actual platform you're running on, the more likely your attack is going to work. A strong attack. The reality is that if you get attacked by one of these guys, you are in trouble. Most large corporations cannot protect against this because they've got production management in place. They're usually well behind the eight ball when it comes to hot fixes and patches and patch clusters. In small businesses, they may not have even realised they needed to move past Service Pack 1, which got installed with NT4 5 years ago. So the reality is, a strong attack will almost always succeed, and they usually have motive for doing it. Real threats arrive from people with motive. The reality is that most of your attacks will come from internal sources. Almost all successful fraudulent activity is internal. And you've got to have good audit controls. As when you go to DEF CON, after this organization, there's some social engineering sessions. I recommend you go and visit them. The social engineering sessions are an exercise in futility. If you can't train your call center staff to detect someone trying to do something against you, you cannot protect your corporation against the call center. And your call center is often considered relatively trusted. The social engineer is a real threat. It is much easier to do almost every single type of attack than actually attacking IT infrastructure. What is an IDS? How many people actually deploy IDSs today? That's about right. That's about what I see in the real industry too. IDSs are very, very hyped, but the reality is not very many people have them. IDSs, in my opinion, are a technology yet to come. It's sort of like PKI. PKI has been with us since 10, 12 years ago, but very few people actually have deployed them correctly. There are basically two types today. Network IDSs, such as Snort, the IIS products, and host IDSs, AID, LogWatcher, Tripwire. Tripwire is probably the seminal IDS product. There's one type of IDS that is really missing today. There's only really one product on the market today that does it, which is Secure IIS's, or EI's product called Secure IIS. One of the guys at work pointed out there's a thing called ASIAN API, but I don't think that's actually relevant in this particular industry. Without application IDS, people are attacking applications. RDS is an application attack. It's not actually an attack against NT. It's an attack against a data service that sits atop IIS that talks to data services. RDSs, it's basically yet another log. If you're actually dealing with an RDS that's generating literally hundreds of thousands of events every week, you are not going to be able to look at that with any sense of, well, what does it actually mean? You can't really give a report that's got 100,000 entries to your boss and say, well, nothing happened this week. The reality is that most of the time, if you don't capture enough information, you may miss things. If you capture little too little, you still miss things. And if you don't have people looking at the logs, there's no point in installing it. One of the financial institutions that I've worked with in the past actually did have decent logging, and they actually had an escalation procedure that got people up literally 40 or 50 times a night because of the way that it was configured. And they tuned it down, and all of a sudden they realized that, well, after all said and done, the audit controls were actually picking up fraudulent activity. They might have been able to pick it up if they'd kept it up, but is it worth getting someone up 40 or 50 times a night to ask, well, do we allow this packet to go through or not? Host IDSs. These are generally not real-time, they are reactive. If you don't review the logs, you're not going to know what's happened. But they are very, very helpful when you're doing forensics. Under Windows 2000 and NT, you really should be configuring up auditing on the directories that you really know. Tripwire is still a useful product. It tells you when you've got like a different binary. Someone might have just uploaded a better working version of cmd.exe. Tripwire can tell you that detail. Auditing really can't. It just tells you that something happened to the file. The reality of open source IDSs, host-based IDSs today is that they're not as good as the commercial host IDSs, but that's due to change. Network IDSs. As I was actually researching this when I actually submitted the paper a long time ago, I just kind of come across Snort. Most of the time I'd actually been working with commercial IDSs and I really hadn't given Snort a good go. as I actually worked through developing the paper and working through some demos, Snort plus Acid. Has anyone played with Acid? Excellent. Acid is excellent. If you go to Snort, the Snort webpage, which is www.snort.org, you will find links to Acid. Acid basically takes all Snort logs, puts them to MySQL, and then it's just a PHP application that sits on top. Acid comes out of Cert. Cert have basically written this application by the looks of things, and it gives you some insight onto what you're actually seeing from Snort. Snort's logs are really voluminous, but by looking through with Acid, you can actually see what's happening. And the reality is that that's what I was really going for with my tool called Litmus. And because Acid is so much better than my tool, then I'm basically saying, well, go with Snort. One of the guys outside, one of the vendors outside, have actually got a tool that works with network RDSs that are greater than 100 megabytes a second, but the commercial RDSs that we have actually tested that run on Solaris, that work on NT, the Solaris ones we get up to about 40 megabits a second, the NT ones about 25 megabits a second, and if you've got a 100 megabits a second network and you're getting up, pushing up towards, you know, normal utilization on busy backbones of 72%, you will miss frames, and when you miss frames, you are missing absolutely essential frame parts of packets that might be attacking you. So the reality is that commercial RDSs, I don't know about Snort, but Snort seems to drop occasional packets there. It depends on what your operating system is. Most commercial RDSs cannot cope with 100 megabit second traffic. Application RDSs. We've been through some of these things. I consider Secure IIS 1.0 or thereabouts, whatever the latest version is. It's really nascent. It's a product that probably needs to be there. It should have been really built into the application. To me, it's more of a shim or a proxy than real protection. It has its own set of faults, and as we've seen, it actually did get bug tracked a couple of times. The guys are pretty cool at fixing it up pretty quickly, but the reality is it's software, it has faults. And that's going to be true of almost all of application RDSs. Where do you deploy RDSs? Well, the best place to deploy an RDS is where you expect traffic to be the least. There's no point in putting it on the backbone of your network or on really, really, really busy servers, because there's going to be so many logs that you're not going to be able to understand what they actually mean. If you put it on the public interface of your router on the internet, you will see port scans all the time. If anybody runs the firewall, how many people run firewalls that have public interfaces at the moment? A few of you. You probably know that you get attacked probably two or three times a week really, really well. But most of the time there's port scans and everything tickling you all the time. If you put an RDS out there, the reality is that they'd just be going off all the time. It's better to see the RDS is deployed in areas where traffic is minimal. Unusual traffic is definitely worth escalating. This bit is, well, I've been really down on a whole bunch of products. I'm really down on the way that most corporates have their security set up. What do you do? And this is what I would recommend. If you don't have the basics of your site set up properly, you're not going to be able to do security properly. You need to reduce your security profile. Most corporations can work on two or three open ports, and they can be even, if you use a load balancer or thereabouts, you can use one IP address. The reality is, defense in depth is great. The more things, the more controls you have, like I went to one of the talks this morning where they were putting firewalls onto individual network cards. As a single point solution, that would be just a waste of time. You don't really improve the security there. But as a layer of defense, it's a good idea. That's the sort of thing you need to consider. You need to have virus protection. You need to have all sorts of things to make sure that from the outside, you can generally not get inside without your consent. Warning banners, low profile, high prosecution profile. Now, the high prosecution profile is actually a double-edged sword. If you go out and make yourself a hard target, people will consider you worthy of a good challenge. The reality is, unless you're someone like a security agency, it's not worth going for here. It's better just simply to try and play it out. Most of the time, if you've got stock, you don't want to be in the media. It's just not really worth your effort. Defend. This is probably the thing that most of us get to do all the time. Keep your systems up to date. Install security helpers such as firewalls. If you do not keep your systems up to date, you will get attacked and they will be successful. Delay. Providing the defense in depth. If you can stop someone for 20 or 30 minutes from getting from one system to another part of your systems, you've done a good job. The last one I put in more of as a flippant sort of comment, but the reality is that if you're large enough, you can cause real pain to a real person for the rest of their life. And what I mean by that is, if you're a telco and you know that person X, and you know that person X did something to you, you can deny them service forever. And if they're the only people in your area that can provide them telco service, they're stuffed. Passive defense. This is where most of us work today. We put in firewalls, we tighten bastion hosts. Often we'll install an IDS or put snort up or something like that. We do logging, and the usual security policy is deny all unless permitted, but that's not always true. Counterattack. I really don't suggest counterattack as a good idea. There's one of the talks here today. There is actually a talk upon a system that will basically sit there, take an attack, and then counterattack. I don't think there's good legal foundings for it, and the reality is that if you're in a country with good InfoSec laws, it's probably illegal. The best you can do is log. Intelligence gathering, I don't think there's anything wrong with this. It's worthwhile finding out who your attacker is if they did enough damage to you. If they're in your own country, it's worthwhile prosecuting. But if they're not in your country, forget it. And this is what happened to a lot of my current clients. They've found out who the person actually is. They know for a fact that the person lives in Pakistan. The idea of getting an extradition is almost impossible. The costs and likelihood of actually getting a prosecution are so small, it's not funny. The reality is that unless you know for a fact that that person did something to you and you're in your own country, don't even think about prosecution. If you don't keep up with patches, you will get attacked. It's as simple as that. And this is absolutely against production management. Production management says we run the system into the ground until it crashes, or it runs out of memory, one of the two. Change management also works against you here, because you need to make sure the patches actually work. But security says if you don't actually have patches, you will get attacked, and you will get hacked. The sad mind worm actually managed to get around to almost every single IIS host in existence. Now, it used a couple of holes that were patched in 1999 and one in about July 2000. If you've been keeping up, you would be immune. If you'd done the IIS checklist, you would be immune. This is really, really, really easy stuff. You've got to go for it. Very few attackers are capable of generating their own attacks, so it's worthwhile sticking to the ones that you can know you can defend against. This is really an unusual one for a security person to come up with, but the reality is if you're managing 30 or 40 external hosts, or say for example 100 or 200 internal servers, if you do not have automated software distribution, you cannot, and I mean you cannot, physically keep up with keeping those hosts in sync and keeping them patched. And the reality is that you've got to test. So you need a test environment, and most places that I've worked at don't have an adequate test environment. Or if they have a development environment that you can use for testing. If you're using something like SMS or the Intel products or Tridge's little rsync, if you're using rsync or any of those products, you've got to trust your source. If you do not just mirror a bunch of RPMs from a place like mirror.rnet.edu.au, someone could actually go and adjust the binary that it was there by putting in a patch. It looked innocuous enough, but it was installed a backdoor. You've got to basically think about how you actually trust that source. If you don't trust the source that you actually deploy, you will have software you don't understand on your systems. business recovery planning. Most places don't have any idea how to recover from a data center loss. They might have written some procedures a while ago, but they probably haven't been ever tested. This includes disaster recovery. Working through this on a regular basis, at least twice a year, is worthwhile. The last point, when I was writing the slides, one of the banks, one of the internet-only banks in England, did not manage the customer expectations. They did not have a call center line for them. When they eventually did set one up, they couldn't tell them anything because they hadn't told the call center to tell the customers anything. You have to tell your customers what's happening. You have to tell them the real risks of what has happened. You can't lie to them. So think about your customers. If you actually do have end customers in your incident response, it is not good enough to just simply try and get back up on your feet. If you've lost all your customers' credit cards, you need to have a way of dealing with the customers' expectations that they will not have fraud perpetrated on their cards. Backups. I went to a bank last week, and their online banking system did not even have a backup. It's really, really basic. It's unbelievably basic. I can't believe that people just don't do this. It's like been with us since the 1960s. If you cannot restore a system, a simple RDS attack, which unfortunately is the most common sort of attack on the internet today, can take you off. One of the systems that I did a bit of forensics on earlier this year, they only lost one file, but it was the file that basically was the front page of their web, and they did not have a copy of it. They did not even have a recent copy of it. They couldn't get that system back up on its feet, even after reinstalling from scratch. They had all the software, but they did not have the actual front page. And the front page is where all the database interaction and everything took place. Effectively, they had to go to manual systems and redevelop the product from scratch, because they did not have backups. Yeah, go for it. Yes. Yeah. Are you talking about Veritas by any chance? it is a real problem, and in fact, one of the problems we actually identified with one of the customers that I've been at recently is also the SAN connected tape storage. They had all their systems, including the ones that are on the front line of the internet, backing up to this SAN, which also backed up their mainframe, which had all their... Just going back, it's just really hard to get some people to understand there must be a difference, there must be an air gap between certain systems. Where you know that you cannot do, for example, you can't change the actual backup password, or it's got to be domain administrator, it's worthwhile separating those systems out. But the reality is that the service account on a certain product from a very large vendor, basically it gives you, if you can do a privilege escalation, gives you domain administrator privileges. And even worse after that, you can restore any file from any other backup. It's a pretty good point. Constantly improve processes. How many of you are familiar with ISO 17799? Cool. More of you should be familiar with this. It's actually extremely high level. It's very, very manager friendly. You can actually create a security policy that says we have no security, and then you're compliant. But the reality is that it points out a whole bunch of things that you should probably think about when you're creating a security policy. The reality of most places I've been to, they don't have a security policy. If they do have a security policy, it's probably hidden in the bottom drawer of someone who declared that entire file cabinet to be top secret. No one's allowed to read it. You've got to improve your processes, and most processes include humans along the line. It is not good enough to have a process or a bunch of systems that are totally secure with humans that just don't know how to do it properly. when you learn something, say for example someone does take you for a ride, it's probably really worthwhile to fix up the reason why they did it. Critical hosts. This is actually one of the things that one of my favorite hobby horses. There is actually a session tomorrow on switches. You really should go to it. At DEF CON, there's another one that talks about switches. If you do nothing on your network layer, on your layer 2 or layer 3 stuff, you will get attacked. One of the ISPs that I've worked at, they basically lost their core router because they had SNMP public rights, they had SNMP private community strings. From that very one single vulnerability, they were able to take over a router, they installed a tunnel. All of a sudden, they had all the hosts. They figured out that one of the hosts was actually promiscuous. They installed their own promiscuous thing on there, and all of a sudden, their entire ISP operation was exposed. It only takes one network element to take over your entire system. Make sure your routers and switches are as secure as your other hosts. Most operating system vendors actually have very security procedures out of the box. For example, if you install SUSE, SUSE Linux actually tells you, okay, what do you want to be? You want to be really secure, you want a medium security? FreeBSD does the same thing. If you can do that stuff out of the box, that's really, really good. But people like Microsoft provide you with a checklist, and that's good too. Run through the checklist. And then you have to do it again next week. Reducing your security profile. Make as many DMZ hosts or extranet hosts invisible to the internet. If you have a common interest network that you share with a whole bunch of your suppliers or other people that you do business with, there's no real reason for that to be visible to everybody on the internet. You only need to make it visible to those people who are actually your partners. For most corporations, you only need your external mail exchange, your web server, and your DNS server. The reality is you can probably farm off your DNS if you don't make that many changes to your ISP, and then your problems go away. You can outsource that function completely. For various reasons, I think it's still a very good idea for you to run your own mail service and your own web server. I've seen examples where the public face of a corporation was running on a virtual host. Microsoft are finding out, to their incredible chagrin, that their various country code .microsoft.coms are run on less than well-secured hosts. I think you're probably better off bringing that thing back in. It's not hard to run a good web server. And use something like the tools that Bill Cheswick's working on to make a map of your network. Visio 2000 Enterprise Edition actually can do this for you as well. You'd be surprised at the number of exceptions. You've got to basically understand where everything's going. Sometimes you can find some real surprises out there. Security posture, policy, you should actually have a security posture. If you don't know what your security posture is, it's probably allow all until told otherwise. This is sort of like the early days of the internet. You connect to the internet and everyone's allowed to browse pretty much any site they like. Recently, it's been sort of like install SenseAware, you're still allowed to, yeah, go for it. You can't do this policy unless you actually have management buy-in. You can set a policy, but no one will believe it unless someone said, yep, that's full. That's on. That's very true. But be reasonable about it. Humans will work around any control you might think desirable. SenseAware is a perfect example. The reality is that it's really easy to work around SenseAware. And I do on a regular basis because I have to go to sites that most SenseAware block. And I'm not talking about those picture sites. I'm talking about places like hack.co.za. It's very easy to work around things like that. If you put in too many harsh controls, you will lose sight of what your users are going to. Because I use a particular type of proxying service that our company provides us to be able to go to various sites without our customers knowing about it, they don't know that I'm going to hack.co.za on their website. I could theoretically go to a bestiality website if I was into that, but they wouldn't know. But I'd still be violating their policy on it. Many of you are probably familiar with the security focus mailing lists, for example, VolmDev, BugTrack, MS Focus, that sort of thing. How many of you are members of those mailing lists? Cool. Well, at the very least, I'd probably suggest that you'd all be worthwhile joining up to BugTrack. BugTrack is high volume. You can get a digest version of it, which only comes out once or twice a day. And then you can keep on top, well, no one really keeps on top of it. You can actually find out what sort of things are popping up on the horizon. Something that turns up in bug track usually starts being a real attack problem 3 to 6 months later. Sometimes a little bit earlier, but usually 3 to 6 months later. For example, a line worm used a couple of exploits from about 3 to 6 months beforehand. Realistically, counterattack is difficult. The reality is that you can only do prosecution. If you think you can actually prosecute because you think the person's actually in the US, or if you're like me, from Australia, you've got to learn the basics of data preservation. I think there is a talk on forensics. Well, hopefully the HoneyNet people will talk about it tomorrow. There is another one. Oh yeah, cool. Tomorrow, 10:30 till 12. Computer forensics, critical process and your incident response plan. That'd be an excellent talk to go to attend. I think I'll be there. The reality is that I even don't know enough about how to preserve the crime scene. Different legal procedures matter in different places. If you've got dirty evidence that you cannot show that you've been able to keep clean, that will be thrown out at the first opportunity. The reality is that good lawyers will try as hard as they can to get as much evidence excluded as possible. You've really got to show in the strongest possible way that your data has been kept perfect. If you can't prove that, don't bother prosecuting because it's just too hard. So that session tomorrow will be really good. Sometimes law enforcement will approach you. You should have a security@yourdomain.com. If you do not have one of those, sometimes it's impossible for the right people to find out who the right people are in an organization. Sometimes you need to approach law enforcement. Say, for example, you find certain types of files that are patently illegal, such as child pornography, and you think you know who did it. There are some times you cannot cover up crimes like that. It's basically participating in the crime. Sometimes these things are really, really hard. So best bet is if you don't understand what's happening, go see a lawyer, then find out what you need to do. In Australia, it's a lot easier. The federal police in Australia actually have quite reasonable people there. Sometimes prosecution can be a bit difficult. And if you get a high profile for being a real hard ass about things, it can be very bad because people will attack you just constantly. I haven't mentioned IDS. In fact, I haven't mentioned PKI. I haven't mentioned half a dozen buzzwords like biometrics or smart cards because they're irrelevant. They really are. If you don't have those basic things down pat, you're wasting your money and you're wasting your time putting in the more esoteric things. The more esoteric things look very funky. In fact, most of the biometric things look very, very cute. The reality is that they don't provide you any additional layers of defense. IDS are the appropriate solution for people who've got everything down pat. Say, for example, you've got all your DMZ hosts well locked down. Your DMZ hosts can't attack each other. You've got decent firewalls in place. You've got decent audit controls. You've got good policies. You've got good virus protection. Everything's working just fine. Let's add the next thing. Let's go for an IDS. That is the appropriate time to add them. I was going to talk about Litmus, but the reality is that I am the maintainer of PNM to PPA, and I'm working with HP. We've actually come out of the woodwork to actually move that into the new architecture. I do almost all of my coding out of hours, and I've only got a limited amount of time. Litmus may never actually see the light of day, and I think actually Snort plus Acid does a much better job than Litmus does today. Snort by itself gives you so much information. If, as long as you look at the logs on a regular basis, you are really, really ahead of the ball game. But, you know, NetFilter, IPFilter, IPChains, all these basic products that do packet filtering plus logging today give you the same sort of information, but to a lesser extent than Snort. Snort plus acid gives you a real view on what's happening out there, and I like it. I like it a lot. If I was going to have some spare time dedicated to coding, I would actually be giving that time away to Snort or Acid, because they are really, really, I think, they're products for the future. Snort has a whole bunch of attack profiles. You can load them in differently, and it's really cool. You should probably give it a whirl. How many people have actually tried Snort? I think I asked that question before. Go give it a whirl. It's so easy to set up. Set up a couple of PCs, go and hammer in Snort, attack it a few times, see how it turns out. The reality is, I think Snort is a really cool product. I think there is a Snort session tomorrow. No, it is actually on now. That's probably where everybody is. Yeah. Snort, go for it. One of the things I wanted to show out of this demo is that Snort and Litmus can both detect an RDS attack and tell you that it's an RDS attack. The reality of most ETK or most honeypots is they cannot tell you that information. The great thing about Snort is that you don't actually have to run up a vulnerable service to find that information out. And as I said, Snort is better. And the more I think about it, it is. Okay, coming to the conclusion, I've still got Tim Tams to give away, so I've had a few questions, so I might have to divide them between the two gentlemen down the front, but we'll go for more Q&A after this. In general, I think that honeypots are never the right answer for any corporate network. They do not give you any additional benefits. They do not lower your risk profile. Realistically, they might be fun to run up to see what they look like, but they're not really designed for corporate networks. The judicious use of various types of RDS can be used to some effect, but reality is that please buy virus protection. Buy some form of software distribution. These are attacks that we see all the time. One of the corporates that I was at recently suffered 120,000 copies of a recent virus going into the corporate network. They caught every single one of them and it didn't infect them. By spending, it probably cost them quite a chunk of money to actually get the external perimeter virus protection there, but it saved them literally millions of dollars from cleaning that up. That, you will get viruses. I tell you now, I've already received a couple of viruses this year. And most of the people I know practice pretty much, you know, safe computer practices. People who do not practice safe computer practices will get a lot more. You will get viruses. The reality is you should spend money on virus protection. Advanced attackers, you may or may not get this year. Okay, we're getting down to questions. Okay, what it was is, realistically, what it was is a configuration of IP filter. So it was just simply an ipf.com file. Plus, I was looking at the logs that it was generating and feeding into MySQL coupled with a web front end. It's ACID, but really, really lame. And the attack signatures that I was starting to generate for it, Snort had them already. And the reality is that Snort has got so many these days that I was already behind the eight ball because I'm just one person, whereas Snort's a whole bunch of people. The reality is that when I get my alpha out of the garage, I'm actually living with my brother and his wife's at the moment while I'm building a house. If I can be bothered, if I can think about it, I might release Litmus then, but right now this is my only computer for the next 5 months, so with VMware not working so well, it may be a while before it's out, and realistically I think Snort plus Acid will develop so far between now and then it's probably worth not worrying about it for the time being. Well, the thing I like about them is that basically, I've got to be honest here, a bit of an disclaimer, our company actually does manage services just like that. You do get someone who's actually focused on managing those type of logs all the time, but they have a lot of customers, maybe they're not giving you the sort of time that you think you deserve. The reality is they're probably filtering a few false positives there sometimes as well, particularly if they're being told, but don't worry about it, by the client a couple of times. They know the product they're actually deploying. That's not always true of people internally. Sometimes you get a lot of churn in network operation centers and not everybody's familiar with the RDS that you might be using. I'm pretty sure that, people like Counterpain who do the same sort of thing, they've probably got some really nice people there and it probably does work. But if you're not setting policy on those managed services, you're not really helping yourself. You're just farming out yet another bunch of logs. I'm not terribly sure it's a really great idea. It's a lot of money. Any other questions? How are we going for time? Got plenty of time. Well, we might draw a close there. Thank you very much.